Keith Thurman is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are being made to execute Thurman by injecting him with massive doses of drugs made to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Execution Watch host Otis McClay, legal analyst Jim Skelton, and criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest John Bessler, law professor and author of Cruel and Unusual, The American Death Penalty and the Founders' Eighth Amendment. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening, and I don't want to say welcome, but you can find out some important information from the show, I think. Tonight in Texas, yet again, March 7th, 2012, an execution, this time a man named Keith Stephen Thurman. My name's Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray Hill while he is running for office, and with me are Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and Larry Douglas. And on the phone from Huntsville right now, we have Gloria Rubeck. Gloria, hi.
Hi, Otis. How are you doing?
Not too good.
I know.
What's going on? What's happening there?
Oh, shoot. The media has crossed the street, and now who's waving at me? I guess Keith Thurman's family and spiritual advisors are now crossing the street.
They're going in.
Oh, there's Catherine Cox. I got to say something on the microphone just a minute. To the family and friends of Keith Thurman, we send our love and our sympathy, and we're standing out here tonight in protest of this legal lynching by the state of Texas. And tonight, Governor Rick Perry now has 241 executions under his belt, which means that half of all the lynchings here in Huntsville can be accredited to Rick Perry. Shame on him. Kathy, we love you.
All right.
I'm sorry. I'm not.
No,
sure.
No. I think that gives us
a
really good.
I'm not sure who all is going in, but they're waving at me. So.
Well, that gives
I
us a really.
Kathy Cox is apparently the spiritual advisor.
Okay, that
and,
gives us a really
I'm
good
not
picture.
Sure who else?
That gives
who
us.
Who else? I was.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Just say that gives us a really good picture of what's going on, and I guess we will hear from you later.
Okay, I just want to tell the guys on death row who are listening that. You know, we send our love and solidarity to them also on this 480th execution.
Yeah, Doyle said that you had a guy there named Carl Rodenberg.
Yeah, Carl. Let me watch.
Did he want to speak?
Yeah, Carl is a man that has supported death row, men on death row, not only in Texas but around the country. And he's elderly gentleman who gets around better than most of us who are younger than him. So I'm going to give you to Carl. Carl,
okay.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm Carl Rodenberg.
And tell me a little bit about why you're here all the way from, Germany.
Well, I come here about two or three times a year visiting people on death row and at the Polanski unit and also in Arizona and California, Pennsylvania, and Florida at this time. Well, I'll be back again later this year. And well, it's always rewarding doing the visits. And
well, I hope you're able to find time to come down to the station on Friday night and be on the prison show. A lot of people listen to that. So, anyway, I'm going to move on, and possibly we'll talk to you later.
All right.
When Gloria calls us back.
All right.
With the bad news.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. Yes?
Can I say regards to all the people that I know on death row at the Polanski's?
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello, everybody at the Polanski unit. Anybody that I know I'm happy to see you, and I will be happy to see you again tomorrow, day after tomorrow, and I'll be back in about 4 months, I think, and see more people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carl. Carl Rudenberg and Gloria Ruback at the Walls unit in Huntsville, witnessing the witnesses and the media. My name is Otis McClay, sitting in for Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. Tonight we are witnessing the execution of Keith Stephen Thurmond. Let's go to Dave Atwood since he's on the line. And he's not. Oh, he's not. Okay. All right. Then Susan. Susan Ashley is going to give us a rundown on what this is all about.
Okay. The facts of the case are, in September 25th of 01, Keith Thurmond shot and killed his estranged wife, Sharon Ann Thurmond, and her 35-year-old boyfriend, Guy Sean Fernandez, in Magnolia, Texas. Sharon had separated from her husband a few months before the murder. She took their child and moved across the street, and she moved in with Guy Sean Fernandez. On the day of the murder, deputies came and served Thurmond with a protective order, and they placed his 6-year-old son in the custody of his wife, Sharon Ann Thurmond. Thurmond later armed himself, and he headed to the home of Guy Fernandez. He found Fernandez, his wife, estranged wife, Sharon Ann Thurmond, and their son in a pickup truck. The son later told deputies that he had seen his father with a gun chasing his mother around the yard while Fernandez ran into the mobile home, and then the boy saw his father shoot his mother a couple times, and he saw his father run into Guy's mobile home with the gun, and the boy told investigators he later heard shots. The boy then ran to his father's home across the street. Keith Thurmond then ran home and barricaded himself and his son in his home. Later, he released the boys because I guess deputies persuaded him to release the boys, and deputies later persuaded him to come out and surrender. And then Keith Thurmond peacefully surrendered to the police a couple hours later. Now, previously on August 30th, 2001, there had been a previous incident where Thurmond traveled to Sharon's mother's home to speak with Sharon, and Thurmond banged on the glass window, the glass door, the patio door, and demanded to see Sharon. The mother told him she was not there and instructed him to leave. Thurmond returned 15 minutes later and again demanded to see Sharon, and Sharon came to the door but did not open it. Through the glass, Thurmond told Sharon, Guy Fernandez, and Sharon's mother that they were all wrong in what they were doing, and that Sharon was going to get hers and he was going to get Guy. And that was admitted. That portion between the two of them was admitted at punishment.
Okay.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about that. Larry's going to talk about punishment.
And I'll let Larry give you the rest of the punishment.
Before we do that, let's go back to the phones. And Dave Atwood is on the line. Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, where are you? Are you at St. Anne's?
Yeah, we're over here at St. Anne's, corner of Westheimer and Shepherd. We've got about 9 people out today, which is a lot better than last week, and looks like...
Yeah, and it's raining.
Huh?
Yeah, and it's raining, I said.
Well, it's almost rainy. It's we get a few sprinkles every now and then. It really hasn't poured. But we've got some great... steady people out here, and like I've said before, you know, we get the 90% of the when we get responses are positive, maybe 95%, and so it's always encouraging to be out here and to listen to how many people are against the death penalty. Really, I think things are really changing. They haven't changed to the point where doing away with the death penalty yet, but they certainly are changing.
Well, that's good to know. But what I would love to have on this is a cost estimate of how much it cost to go through this process for this particular guy. I wonder how much it was. You know, how many people could have been fed on that?
Yeah, anyway. Yeah. The cost of the death penalty is outrageous. Most people don't realize it costs more to to go through that whole death penalty procedure, the execution, more costly than putting somebody in prison for a long time. It's an education thing that we need to do, and we always find out that so many people who are sort of ambivalent on the death penalty, once they get educated, will be against the death penalty once they get the facts.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you. I hope a lot of cars honk as they pass by.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We got a good group out here. Thanks for doing the show.
Okay. Later.
All righty. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dave Atwood on the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd. It's outside of St. Anne's Church. Houstonians know where that is. And when people drive by and they see them there, nine people standing there opposing the death penalty, they actually participate by honking or flashing their lights. That's nice to know. My name is Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray Hill. In the studio with me on Execution Watch here, Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and Larry Douglas. And sitting at the controls, Doyle and our producer, Elizabeth Stein. So from Susan, we heard a rundown on what happened, you know, the story of the crime. Had the trial, found guilty, and then it went to the punishment phase.
Right. And Otis, as we've discussed before, in Texas, all criminal cases are broken up into two parts, the guilt innocence phase and then the punishment phase. But in a death penalty case, a death penalty case, the choices are either life or death. So
you mean life without parole at this point?
At this point,
yeah.
Okay, but in essence, still life or death.
Yeah.
And so Keith Thurman had been found guilty of killing his ex-wife, or his estranged wife, and her boyfriend. So at punishment, what the prosecutors used was his past. A lot of his past tendencies to be violent toward women. So one witness that they had was a former girlfriend who dated him for about 4 years. And he had been violent in that relationship from almost the very beginning. He was shown to have slapped her and hit her and so forth. And that he was very, very controlling. And she testified that she was afraid of it. And that she wanted to try to leave him. And eventually she did leave him. But after she left him, what he did was he went to her home and sexually assaulted her at knife point. That was part of the evidence at punishment. So after that, she was convinced he was going to try to do it again. So she left her home. Her sister came and picked her up, and she left. But then later on, when she returned to her home, she found the door lock had been broken. So at that point, what she did was she called the police. And the police come and they find him actually inside her house, and that he was carrying a 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun. That was part of the testimony of her testimony in the punishment phase against Mr. Thurman. There was another wife, a common law wife, who testified that they had been during their common law marriage that he'd been violent toward her. That he had hit her on several occasions, and that when she did finally told him that she was going to leave him, he threw her on the floor, straddled her, and started choking her, and then he kept harassing her until finally she got a restraining order against him. And then also the other punishment evidence that Susan has talked about before, that is his relationship with the estranged wife, where, you know, I'm talking less than a month before the murder. That incident of him going to her house, to Sharon's house, and then threatening Sharon and the boyfriend, Fernandez, letting them know that, you know, Sharon, you guys are doing wrong. Sharon, you're going to get yours, and Guy, I'm going to get you. Also, while he was in prison, because they try to throw as many crimes and bad acts as they can against you when they're seeking the death penalty in the punishment phase. So they said that while he was incarcerated, he was disciplined for various different reasons. One, for not wearing his armband that he was required to wear, and also for being disrespectful to staff members. They gave him a warning. He continued to violate those disciplinary rules, and he was then had all of his privileges revoked. And when that happened, He later threatened to kill the disciplinary officers who were involved in the case. So all of those kinds of things, and I'm sure there were other things that were introduced at punishment, were introduced for the purpose of convincing the jury to answer the questions in such a way as to give the death penalty.
Now, in the punishment phase, though, you allow evidence that that's not admissible in the trial phase. Is that correct?
That's correct. That is correct.
The rules are much looser in the punishment phase. They can drag up his yellow sheet and all that other stuff.
If a defendant does not testify at the guilt and innocence phase, then typically that kind of evidence is not admissible. And most defendants do not testify
in the trial
in the guilt
phase.
And innocence phase.
Right.
That's correct. And there are certain conditions under which things can come up in guilt innocence. Typically, prosecutors, rather than risking the problem of a reversible error, stay away from that. But at punishment phase, everything comes up, not just convictions, not just crimes, but also bad, even acquittals. Even things where the grand jury might have no-billed a person, you know, all of those bad acts can come up during the punishment phase.
So they brought everything in.
Basically. Otis, you're right as you can be, because what happens at the punishment phase, they claim they need to give a lot of information to a jury, and they say over and over again that their rules of evidence are very relaxed, and basically what it amounts to is anything that a judge deems relevant that the jury should know about sentencing. And as a matter of fact, we were discussing today at our Wednesday class at punishment hearings, they've even admitted evidence where people have been no-billed on crimes, they've admitted evidence where people have been acquitted of crimes. All of this comes in. And in this case, basically, can you imagine going to trial with your life at stake and everybody interviews your ex-wives? What's going
right.
to happen to you? Because
right.
basically, this guy and the defense, and this is what you call a lawyer's nightmare, because there is absolutely no question about guilt or innocence. And what made it so particularly egregious, in fact, the trial lawyer that tried the case said the thing that was most troublesome from his viewpoint was that he killed the mother in front of the child. And, you know, like in Montgomery County, or probably any county, not only just
Montgomery.
Is
this Montgomery County?
Uh-huh, Montgomery
okay.
County. And so this happened in Magnolia, which is Montgomery County. And there's no question about guilt or innocence. So what in the world do you do when you go to trial? You've got a man who's caught at the scene. You've got a man that killed his wife, and he's got the murder weapon in front of his own child who's a witness, plus all the neighbors who are witnesses. How do you defend that case? It's an absolute total nightmare, because guilt is absolutely assured. There's no question about the man's guilt. The only question is a matter of punishment. And then on punishment, when you have all these women coming in talking about all the things you'd done to him in times past and the threats he had made and raping former women and things like that, it's an absolute lawyer's nightmare, because you literally have nothing to work with. This is why it makes it so difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's a question that a lot of people have. Certainly I do, is how do you deal with that as a defense attorney? Because we have this idea of fair trial and innocent until proven guilty, although that seems to be changing.
And see what makes this.
And you have evidence that's basically irrefutable.
Right.
You cannot. This is not even questionable witness stuff or you know, any of the things that you might be able to. I don't know.
To work with.
I mean, all you got here is he's nuts. I mean,
well, you got a deal. He has a bad. My idea was castrate him, cut him loose. He's bad around women.
I don't know if that would help.
Because what's happened, what was interesting about this case is a couple of things, and Barry Larry and I touched about this earlier. What's interesting about this case, this man had no prior convictions. And as you well know from following these shows before, when we have these programs, normally somebody who's been in and out of pen, in and out of jail, in and out of trouble, this guy had no prior convictions at all. His only problems happened to be with women. And like I say, he had no priors to speak of at all. And then the fact that you have absolutely no defense to the murder case itself, plus you have a man killing a woman in the presence of his own child. And that's the sort of thing that exacerbates and just makes it impossible to try to do anything.
Yeah.
So what do you do to defend it?
Yeah, this is the cycle of violence, in case anybody is interested, who's listening, who has any issues with that. Cycle of violence is consistent. It's the same
right.
thing all the time, where the perpetrator, who is usually male, will basically find a reason that the victim has made him do something, and then the violence will occur, and then at the end of it, you get the apology at the end of that, and then that cycle begins all over again.
Let's don't forget this, Otis. Well, don't forget.
I wanted to say one thing.
Go ahead.
This cycle ends in murder, inevitably, because they're not getting what they need, what they think they need. It just gets worse. And the only way to break it is to get out, or, you know, and the perpetrator has got to do some serious counseling and want to do it.
But see, there's a second, part, we've got to be honest about this. The idea, if this woman that was married to him had to known his violent nature, and the idea that she'd move across the street.
Well, that was my question.
Now, that is just like an act of madness, because she moves across the street with a neighbor across the street and takes the guy's kid away from him. And, you know, you'd think that if somebody was around somebody that violent, the last thing they'd want to do is get as far away as possible. If I was across the street living with another man's wife and kid, I'd be carrying a machine gun with me to protect myself.
Say the other thing about the cycle of violence, unfortunately, and Susan or, you know, anybody can speak to this, there is a codependency going on.
Right.
Because so many times I would take calls at hotline about this is happening, and I would say, because of what we know about the cycle of violence, you have to leave. The only way women can control
and not
men
across the street.
The only no, but I'm saying, but that's like a come on in a way.
Yeah.
The only way women can control men is through boundaries. We're not being around when the guy does something that's inappropriate or unacceptable. You cannot tame men. You have to stop. All you can do is say, I will not tolerate it. And that so rarely happens in these cases. Susan, did you want to say something?
Well, maybe.
And I'm not
Sharon,
putting women down. What?
Well, I think we've done a pretty good job on this show, and I think I should stand up
in
for
what,
women
in
here.
What respect?
And I'm going to do it. Now,
okay.
Hold on here.
Okay.
I'm getting ready to go on a roll.
Good.
Okay. So, buckle your seatbelts. Now, first off, in fairness, what Jim made the comment about ex-wives coming in and saying bad things about you, about men on trial.
And girl, yeah.
Okay. There are many cases where ex-wives have actually come and defended their ex-husbands. Yeah. One quite well-known case was in the JonBenet Ramsey case. He was never put on trial, but it was such a big, you know, public.
Yeah.
It was in the media. One of the most compelling people that spoke for John, for the father, said, "You know, I'm his ex-wife. I've had children with him. I can tell you, he would never, ever, ever hurt any of his children." That he was an excellent father, and she spoke highly of him, and she was very persuasive, and she had no reason to lie. So there's many cases.
But he also may not have been a violent person.
Well, that's true, but my point is, you have to also remember this. At a trial, or, you know, just in, say, if you're the Ramses in the court of public opinion, if your former ex-wives and ex-girlfriends can say good things about you and mean it, it happens to be very persuasive, okay? I mean, I think it is.
Yes,
okay,
I agree.
That they would take it upon themselves to come forward to defend the guy. So, you know, I think that, but in this case, that was not the case with Mr. Thurman. Also, as far as, obviously, you could say Sharon Ann might have chose a better place to go live after.
So.
But at the same time, that might have been really her only choice.
Yes,
okay.
That's entirely possible.
You see, it might have been her only choice. It might have been the easiest way for her to get out of the situation with Keith Thurman was the guy, whatever, across the street. And I agree, Guy.
I do not disagree with anything you said. I can only go from my experience that there seems to be this resistance on the part of women to leave these relationships when they're clearly going on, but I love him is what I heard over and over again. And this is not a women thing. This is how we operate as a culture thing. Because it's like, no, you hit me. That's it. I'm out of here. I don't tolerate that in my life. Gloria.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, Otis. Nobody has come out yet but a few employees, so I guess he had a lot of witnesses with him, including Kathy Cox, and many of the guys on the row know because
Kathy Cox was a witness?
Yeah.
Okay.
She visits every Thursday and Friday and has done so for the last, 30 years? So she was waving at me. And then Ward Larkin, who's also an abolitionist and visits a lot of the guys, I'm pretty sure that was him going in. And I don't know who the third person waving at me was. So I understand that Keith has a good friend from Canada who is here and witnessing. And here they come.
They're coming out?
Well, yeah.
Boy.
This looks... There's Kathy Cox. Okay, this is his family and friends that are now coming out of the execution chamber, which means that Keith Urban has been murdered by the state of Texas tonight. George Bush is now has over half.
No, Rick Perry.
I mean, Rick Perry, whatever.
Yeah.
Same idiot.
Same guys.
Same fascist. So, yeah, they're all walking across the street. I usually...
All right.
Wow.
If you want to follow, call back if you need to. Okay, call back if you got stuff.
Okay.
All right.
I will. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Right.
And
Gloria Ruback.
Everybody on death row.
Gloria reporting from the walls unit, from outside the walls unit, that this execution is over and Keith Stephen Thurman is dead. They, and Jim reminded me to say with the ritual that they follow now is they will take that body to the funeral home so that the family can go there and, you know, hold his hand or whatever while the body is still warm. I'm not sure what the significance of that is. I mean, you know, the more we ritualize the things, the easier it is to get away with them. You know, the more you institutionalize it and make it seem like, well, this is just the way it's done, the easier it is to do it. Because, you know, if he started from scratch maybe and you said, I got this idea, let's kill people that we don't like, you know, maybe some people would say, no, that's a crazy idea. I don't think we should do that. You know, send them somewhere else. I don't know. The whole thing is so insane. Susan, you had
yes,
something.
You know, there's certain things. I wasn't quite finished with my little role there.
Rock and roll.
Okay, there's certain things, and I was saying this to Jim earlier. There's certain things that a woman can't defend herself against, like a woman cannot physically defend herself against
right.
a man. And what she's probably going to do is depend on another man to defend her from a man that's going to attack her. And chances are Sharon Thurman thought that Guy Fernandez could defend her against Keith Thurman.
With a description of him running into his house while he's chasing her with a gun seemed kind of interesting to me.
Anyway, there are other things that a man cannot defend himself against, such as false accusations of molesting a child or false accusations of domestic violence. Men are not good at defending themselves at that. The people who can really defend a man in those cases happen to be women. They are their ex-wives, the women in their lives, and their women lawyers. And women are way more effective at defending a man in those cases. And so that, you know, I mean, we have to look at it like Sharon Thurman might, under the circumstances, she might not have had the money to, shall we say, get an apartment across town. She might have thought that Fernandez would be able to defend her.
Yeah, and we cannot walk, we have not walked in their shoes.
Yes.
And I know that. I can only speak, and what I was saying was basically abstractions and things that I've experienced. And one of the things that we don't discuss in the cases with the cycle of violence is where do the women go? I mean, there are people who do not have family to go to, who do not have a place to go, who are not
money.
Financially independent. And a lot of that isn't included in these discussions. So I'm remiss in that respect.
And Larry, the basic money, too.
Yeah, the money. And the way, but women are already marginalized. In the way we operate, it's in these situations, and then we treat them as though they were equal, and they're not.
Well, I don't think I'm not going to say women are not marginalized. In the example, what I just gave you, there's cases that obviously only a man can defend a woman, but there are cases that only a woman can really defend a man.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, because of the way we structure our families and so forth, women are much more likely not to be financially independent and much more likely not to be able to act independently. And further, the training in our society is that they're not allowed to, that they're supposed to be, you know, somehow attached to the man. That's all. I'm only bringing that up. Do you think I'm putting women down?
I don't think women are all that marginalized. Okay. Oh.
And with the debate going on in the Republican primary, okay, we'll suspend this for a minute, because this is really interesting to me. This is an interesting thing. And Larry, I know you had something you want to say. On the line with us, we have John Bessler, who is, you're a professor, aren't you?
Yes, that's right.
That's why it says Prof. John Bessler. Are you at Northeastern? I didn't even look at this. Forgive
me. No, I teach a death penalty course at Georgetown.
Okay, in D.C.?
Yes, uh-huh.
Georgetown, the source of all of our diplomats. Very good. Dr. Bessler has written a book here called Cruel and Unusual, The American Death Penalty and the Founders' Eighth Amendment, Cruel and Unusual Punishment. This has just come out. I have not even had a chance to look at it, okay? I mean, I literally walked in the station. It was here. Tell us what's in this that we want to know, or that you want us to know.
Sure. The book basically is looking back at the history of the death penalty in the United States and the way the Eighth Amendment, the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, has been interpreted. And I think a lot of people think of the Founding Fathers as having been really gung-ho for the death penalty. And in looking back at the evidence, I found that was really not the case, that there was a lot of ambivalence even back in the 18th century surrounding the death penalty issue. So Dr. Benjamin Rush, for example, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, was opposed to all forms of capital punishment. And if you look at other figures like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, Jefferson and Madison also sought to curtail severely the death penalty in Virginia. Jefferson was involved in drafting a bill in the 1770s to try to limit the death penalty to cases of treason and murder. That was a bill that James Madison actually pushed for in the Virginia legislature. It failed at that point by one vote in Virginia. But if you look at the history of the death penalty, you know, back at the founding era, there was not the well-developed system of public penitentiaries, state penitentiaries that we have today. And so, looking back, Madison was fascinated actually by the idea that state prisons one day would be able to serve as a substitute for what he called the cruel inflictions, so disgraceful to penal codes. And so there was a lot of talk even back at the founding era about whether or not the death penalty should be abolished, even for cases of murder. There was debate back then. And of course today we have life without parole sentences as an alternative to the death penalty. The death penalty has changed a lot since the Founding Fathers' time. We have discretionary sentences now, whereas the founding era we had mandatory sentences. So in other words, if you committed a murder, the automatic sentence was death. So death was the usual punishment, whereas today everything is being, all the punishments being discretionary, you're bound to have a lot of invidious factors such as race, for example, creep into executions, and it makes it very likely that executions will be unusual in the extreme. And sort of being struck by lightning in a sense. If you look at the number of murders in the country versus the number of people actually executed, it's a very small percentage. And so it has more to do with geography, really, than anything else. If you look at the counties, for example.
Harris County, right.
Harris County, I think 9 out of the 15 counties that execute the most people are in Texas, so in one state. So, and even within Texas, if you look at the statistics, I think Texas has something like 254 counties. I think 4 counties account for over half of the executions in Texas. So even within a state, it depends sort of not necessarily on the nature of the crime, but on where the crime was committed.
It sounds like a cultural issue. I'm curious why the Eighth Amendment was in the Bill of Rights. Was there, because the Bill of Rights, there was some contention. It was an agreement that the contents of the Bill of Rights would be put in as an amendment rather than included in the Constitution.
Right.
I'm just wondering why the Eighth Amendment.
One of the Bill of Rights incorporated within the text of the Constitution itself. He lost that battle. But the reason we have the Eighth Amendment language, it actually comes from England. It's an English, the English Declaration of Rights from 1688 had that cruel and unusual punishments language, and it was adopted verbatim in the Virginia Declaration of Rights by George Mason. And then when the Bill of Rights was drafted, Madison looked to his home state and adopted that same language. Interestingly, in other places like Massachusetts and in the Northwest Ordinance, which had abolished slavery for those that area northwest of the River Ohio, you had the language being cruel or unusual punishments. But Madison, because he was from Virginia, looked to Virginia's text and put that in the what's now the Eighth Amendment.
Nobody has a question. This is what kind of response have you gotten from this? You've done obviously a lot of research because we got like 304 almost 400 pages here. What have you come up with if you were going to sum it up? You know, after all of this work and this research into the death penalty and our history with it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I take away is, you know, if you look at the Eighth Amendment, the way it's been interpreted, the Supreme Court has looked at the Eighth Amendment and they've applied what's called the Evolving Standards of Decency test. Of course, those words are not words that are actually in the Constitution. When they look at the Evolving Standards test, they've focused on things like whether there's a national consensus against a particular punishment or whether there's a trend one way or the other. And again, that language is not actually in the Constitution. And I think one thing I take away is if you look back at the text of the Constitution and you look at the concept of cruelty, I think that's what the Supreme Court should be focused on, along with the term unusual. And as I mentioned before, again, when you have a system that developed at the common law, and punishments used to be handed out pursuant to the common law in the days of William Blackstone and when they had the English, what was called the English Bloody Code, where over 200 felonies were punishable by death in England. If you committed a crime, the punishment was mandatory that it would be death. The statutes referred to, shall be death, essentially. So it was a mandatory punishment. But once the Supreme Court moved away from that, and actually the Supreme Court itself has held that mandatory death sentences are actually unconstitutional, you've created a situation where you're definitely going to guarantee arbitrariness in the system. And if you look back at the effect of the 14th Amendment and combine that with the 8th Amendment, again, the 14th Amendment essentially applied the Bill of Rights to the states. And so before the 14th Amendment, the 8th Amendment only applied to the national government, which was quite small. And once you had the 14th Amendment, it applied the concept of the 8th Amendment to the states, in addition to, again, the federal government. And the 14th Amendment added the concept of equal protection of the laws. And I think you've got to read that concept of equal protection of the laws along with the 8th Amendment to understand what the 8th Amendment means in this day and age.
Well, it seems that the equal protection under the law is long gone. Forgive me, but
they decided a case called McCluskey in the 1980s, which essentially said that even though study after study has shown that there's racial discrimination in the death penalty system, and it particularly focused on the race of the victim discrimination, that the person in that case, Warren McCluskey, had to prove discrimination in his case. There's a couple of states, Kentucky and North Carolina, which passed what were called Racial Justice Act statutes, which essentially reversed that ruling in those states. And there's been a proceeding in North Carolina going on looking at that issue. But again, the statistics are pretty clear that the discrimination remains in the death penalty system. And I think if you look at the arbitrariness of the death penalty, it is, as one of the justices wrote in Furman back in 1972, it remains a system where who gets a death penalty essentially is determined by being struck by lightning. There's a lot of murders that take place in this country, and a very, very small percentage of people end up getting the death penalty, and it's basically depending on geography, and even then, the county where the person is executed. And so that's a system that runs counter to the American system of sort of equal justice for all, and is focused very much on arbitrariness, and that's a concept also that the Due Process Clause is also aimed to prevent arbitrariness in our justice system.
Did you have any sense, or did you speak to it in the book again, since I haven't read it? And I should remind everybody, we're talking with Professor John D. Bessler, who has just published a book called Cruel and Unusual, which is a history of the death penalty in the United States, published by Northeastern University Press, if you're interested. you get any sense of or dealing with the effectiveness of the death penalty in doing what it says it's supposed to do, which is, you know, somehow prevent murder?
Well, if you look at the statistics, again, I'm not a statistician, but if you look at the studies that have been done and the raw statistics, the FBI data, you see that death penalty states tend to have, on average, higher murder rates than non-death penalty states in terms of averages. So, for example, the murder rate in the South, where the death penalty is the most active, is higher than it is in the Northeast, for example, where there are very few executions take place. So I think in terms of the efficacy, when you compare it to life without parole is a very good option, keeps the public safe. At the same time, it allows the system not to carry out an execution where we may have an error occur. We've had about 140 people, according to the Death Penalty Information Center, who have been exonerated. And there's over 15 cases of DNA exonerations from people that were on death row. We know that mistakes are made, and if we want to have a justice system that allows and recognizes that, I think life without parole, which is a very, you know, it's a very severe punishment, but that's the way we should go to ensure that our system can correct mistakes when we find them.
All right. What would you like to leave us with?
Well, I think that the
that's
the
pretty good.
I would
leave what you
with is to think back to the founding era and think about the founders themselves, and that they were debating this issue even over 200 years ago. Thomas Paine, who wrote the Common Sense, which and is called the father of the American Revolution, said that and wrote in one of his books. It says, when in countries that are called civilized, we see age going to the workhouse and youth to the gallows, something must be wrong in the system of youth and the support of old age, support of age. And people like William Bradford, who was James Madison's close college classmate at Princeton, wrote an essay in 1793 called An Inquiry, How Far the Punishment of Death is Necessary in Pennsylvania. And in that, he advocated the elimination of the death penalty for everything except murder. And even for murder, he wanted to study the question and thought that the issue could be resolved by looking at the evidence. And I think the evidence is in at this point that the death penalty is not effective. The police chiefs all say that. For the most part, a very large percentage of them, that it does not lower homicide rates. And I think it's time for the American system to do away with the death penalty, as many, many countries around the world have. So that's what I guess that's what I'd like to leave your listeners with.
Well, thank you very much, Professor John D. Bessler. His book, Cruel and Unusual, A History of the Death Penalty in the United States, recently, just newly published by Northeastern Press. I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. And a caller reminds us this after I made that, you know, talked about they take the body of the executed victim to the funeral home. And one of the reasons people go there, and this is what the caller reminds us, is that they have not been allowed any physical contact with that prisoner. I have never been to Polonsky. You know, I have
many times.
I mean, and Polonsky is one of the new high security prisons, right?
I would say it's not that new.
No,
it's not. I mean,
because they used to be on the wall at Ellis too. And the death row.
The whole point is what they're trying to say is that, unlike other states, when someone's going to be executed, the family can't have any contact with them physically. Now, like Louisiana, they can have contact. In Texas, they will not permit the family to get in touch the defendant prior to the death. It's only after they're dead they can touch them. That's what's morbid about it. That's what they're talking about.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's like the sentence is the punishment, but they keep punishing them. I mean, this is the way
one thing I want to mention, and maybe I'm the only one.
This is Jim Skelton, by the way.
I'm crying the wilderness on this. People keep saying that this life without parole is a good option. I'm strongly against that. Let me tell you why. Life without parole is, in fact, a death sentence. Period. And the thing about it, from a legal viewpoint, from a lawyer viewpoint, if you have a regular death penalty case and are seeking the death penalty, at least you have the opportunity to present mitigating evidence. When it's life without parole, you don't have got the opportunity to present mitigating evidence. Give me a good example, and this may be a case that we've first fussed about. For example, in a regular murder case, let's say, for example, that I killed somebody, but I can prove that when I killed that person, There's a thing called sudden passion. What that basically amounts to is I become enraged over some adequate cause. For example, let's just take this case. Let's say, for example, and everybody knows you're at your worst probably during a divorce, and you're at worst when it's your custody battle. That's when people really get crazy. And let's say that I'm a man and my wife has moved across the street with another man and living directly across the street with my wife. And then she has me served with papers, and they take my child away, and they move my child away across the street with this man that's living with my wife. That would enrage most people. And when you're in that rage, and the way the law talks about it, rage is, and when I talk about sudden passion, basically it's tantamount to temporary insanity. You're not thinking clearly because you're provoked by an adequate cause. And if you kill while in that sudden rage, that's a mitigating issue in a regular murder case. For example, if I'm charged with regular murder, the punishment range is 5 to life. But if at punishment I can prove that I murdered under sudden passion, and what I got to be able to prove is that what provoked me was adequate cause.
Why is that not part of the
that's the part with the law
the
says.
Trial.
That's because they say it's a mitigating issue in a regular murder case. Why is it? Because the legislature passed it.
Okay.
Because let me go back again. Murder means you deliberately and intentionally kill somebody. But if you can show at punishment that you were enraged by an adequate cause and you weren't thinking clearly when you did the murder, it's called sudden passion. Then the punishment range is reduced from 2 to 20 as opposed to 5 to life. Now, in a capital murder case, the sudden rage issue is not available. Now, you take this particular case.
I was going to say, why was this capital murder as opposed to...
The reason is capital murder because there's two people killed in one transaction.
Okay.
And see, this is what I have complained about over and over
again. And yet, the sudden rage could completely encompass that.
It's understand. I'm not saying it's justified in killing somebody.
No, I know.
But you can understand why a man would become enraged if his wife moves across the street, moves in with another man, shacking up with him, and takes his kid away. That's going to really hack you off. And that's understandable. I'm not saying it's justifiable, but it's understandable.
Yeah.
That issue could not be submitted to the jury in this case. Now, the same thing is true of when they have this life without parole. You cannot submit sudden passion issues to a jury. In a regular murder case, you can. If a guy comes home and finds a man in bed with a wife in bed with another man, just blows up and kills both of them, that's capital murder because you've got two murders committed in one transaction, same as this one. But the sudden passion issue is not available. And this is why I hate that life. A life parole is not a good option. It's a mandatory death sentence. Because if you only got two options, death or life without parole, they're both the death sentence. One of them is just quicker than the other, assuming you live that long.
So, Jim, you're saying, though, if the man comes home and catches the wife in the bed, if he kills just one of them, he's got sudden passion.
Well, he kills both of them. It could be sudden passion.
But if I'm just saying, and under the current law,
sure.
If he only killed one of them, it's just a regular murder.
Sure.
In which case, he can get sudden passion, but if he kills them both,
that's it.
He can't.
And see,
did any of this come up? I'm just curious. Did any of this come up in the punishment phase?
It's not part of the law.
Can't get it in.
On the current law.
You couldn't even bring it into the punishment phase.
That's my whole point, Otis. My whole point is that you can use, in a regular murder case, sudden passion as a mitigating factor. It is not a mitigating factor in a capital murder case, and it should be. Because in this particular case, and I'm not saying these people deserve to be killed. I'm not even beginning to suggest that. I'm just simply saying.
No, what you're doing is outlining the situation.
Exactly.
You're not advocating or justifying.
You
are outlining the situation. Okay.
Exactly. Because that's when I get so offended when people keep saying that we're making progress with life without parole. It is another form of the death sentence. When they say this, you shouldn't have mandatory death if your only options are put somebody on a gurney and stick them full of deal or letting Mother Nature kill them. Both of them were the death sentence.
Well, a number of people have chosen, a number of prisoners have said, I would rather be put to death than spend my life in this.
Of course.
The last place. Execution of one of the Texas Seven.
Right.
I mean, that was the case of saying, I don't want to live this way for the rest of my life, so either I'm going to break out of this place or die doing it.
But it seems that, and this is so typical of the law, forgive me, because you work in it, but it seems so typical of the law that it really misses the point a lot. Because, every murder is different. And the recidivism rate in murder is historically very low.
Something else I want to mention, too, is while we're on that subject. When you have life without parole, you're giving incentive for people to want to break out of prison and not behave. Because you take that group that they executed, the group of seven that left, virtually all of them are serving life without parole sentences. So what control do you have if you're running a prison, if guys have no hope of getting out?
Well, we have consistently, we mentioned this last week, that in Texas we've taken away good time, we've taken away all of the tools that the prison staff had to control the inmates,
short
of going in with, you know, billy clubs and all of the stuff that we see on MSNBC.
But all I'm saying is everybody running around claiming, oh, we're making progress because we've got life without parole, I think they're crazy.
What would be, we got about four more minutes, what would be progress? Oh, no, the next question is, was there anything you want to say about the appeal? Because
in this case, I thought there would be a stay of execution. Let me tell you why. Here's a big hot issue in death penalty cases. When you go into federal court after you exhausted all your state remedies, you are limited in federal court to your review of what was brought up in state court. If an issue is not brought up in state court, you can't relitigate it in federal court.
You cannot do guilt or innocence, basically.
Well, you can't introduce new evidence. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Let's take this particular case. Number one, they do a direct appeal, and there's very little to appeal. I mean,
it's automatic.
Automatic.
Right?
Direct appeal, but there's hardly any issues involved. Guy kills his wife in front of his own child, and there's no issues involved. Direct appeal is a slam dunk. So you go in on a post-conviction writ. At that post-conviction writ, they're saying the lawyer is ineffective. But what they did not do when they did the post-conviction writ, this guy had apparently a very troubled childhood. He had been abused, had been physically abused by his father, emotionally abused, and raised apparently in a bad home. Those are usually mitigating facts that can be brought into punishment. This was not brought up during the state writ. When it gets into federal court, they try to bring it up then, and the law says you can't do it. You're barred. So the big issue is, can you get a second writ filed if your first writ lawyer didn't do a good job? That's what's currently pending in the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is why I thought there may be a stay on this.
Was there a basis for the stay on this issue?
That's exactly what they argued in front of the Supreme Court, because here's what they said. There was a question of whether or not they should have submitted mitigating facts that punished him because of his troubled childhood. Since it was not brought up in the state courts and brought up for the first time in federal court, it's procedurally barred. And therefore, they're saying the lawyers that did the state writ were ineffective, and they should be able to come back and redo that writ again. Now, this issue is now pending to the Supreme Court. Can you get a new writ filed?
I mean, there is a case now on
this
issue.
Supreme Court case pending.
Okay.
In fact, there have been two Texas executions that have been stayed pending the outcome of the Supreme Court decision. Because the question is real simple. Can you file a subsequent writ if your first writ lawyer was ineffective? That's the issue. And that was exactly the argument this man made in the Supreme Court, that my writ lawyers were ineffective. They didn't bring up the troubled childhood as ineffectiveness. They didn't bring that issue up. And therefore, it's procedurally barred in federal court, and I should be able to file a subsequent writ. That's why I thought there would be a stay, because they've granted two already in Texas on that, and that's currently pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, that issue. And they wanted to give a stay on this to the Supreme Court to resolve that issue.
Well, in a sense, does not giving a stay suggest the direction that they're headed on that issue?
No, what I think it probably is. I think if they didn't give a stay, and I was telling some more people this today, if they didn't grant a stay, they would have thought perhaps there's no merit to his claim about a troubled childhood.
Well, it's clear that that was his training.
Right.
His training was you use violence to solve problems.
Right.
I mean, that's his training.
They could have thought there's no merit to the claim. That might have been the reason. I don't think it gives you any indication what they're concerned about. They're concerned about a successive writ being filed and delaying the procedure further. And if they permit you to come in now and claim that a lawyer is ineffective by filing a writ, this can grant further delays in executions.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they're concerned about.
Well, the move has been away from extended stuff where why can't I have his name? The previous Chief Justice was very big Rehnquist was very big on shutting down habeas corpus and limiting it.
What they obviously want is you put everything you have in the first writ, and that's your only shot.
But they were trying to make it efficient. You know, like the law is efficient. I mean,
If justice is not efficient to begin with, it's not built for efficiency, it's built for fairness.
It's not supposed to be.
It's not supposed to be efficient. I mean, if you want to be efficient, you could use a computer and get rid of these lazy judges. You want to be efficient.
My name is Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. We have attended the execution of Keith Stephen Thurmond. He was put to death about 6:25 tonight. And I'm sitting here with Jim Skelton and Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas. And I think we're about at the...
We got about three more minutes.
We got to be out by 58, so we had 3 minutes. Susan, do you have something you want to say? Is there anything you want to add to what we were talking about before?
Well, yes, I will add one thing. I will say this. Let's not end the show for anyone thinking that women are marginalized or victims.
What do you mean by marginalized? I don't understand.
Otis used the word, so I get to go on this.
Well, say the attempt is
nobody
there,
is marginalized unless you, man, woman, whoever you are, wherever you are in life. Nobody's marginalized unless you allow yourself to be marginalized.
I think you should tell that to the women in Virginia.
The women in Virginia.
All I'm saying, if you leave your husband, don't move across the street and take.
No, they were
going
to pass a law in Virginia that if you wanted to have an abortion,
I agree with you.
This is the kind of thing I'm talking about, and I'm saying this is in our culture, and it makes it much more difficult in a way for women to act independently, truly, and even men. I mean, it's a cultural issue.
I mean, that would be, as they say on Oprah, that would be a whole nother show. I agree with you on it. But
10 shows.
That would be a whole nother show. But
well, that was where I was coming from.
Okay.
I'm talking about that kind of approach to women. I mean, if I were king, the first thing I would do would be to change the law so that you use the mother's name instead of the father's.
Well, I mean...
Think about that one. I would go to a matrilineal system.
Well... I, you know...
I'm glad you're not king, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I would still, you know, reiterate my point that on some things, nobody really can defend a man better than a woman can.
Oh, I agree.
And do it well. In this case, if this man, let's just say he had previous ex-wives that would come and say good things about him, the outcome could have been different.
It probably would have been quite different.
They've been that good.
We're done. We're out of here. Yeah. And unfortunately, on Wednesday, March 28th, that's 2 weeks, I guess, 3 weeks, Jesse Hernandez will be facing the same fate here in Texas. For Execution Watch, for Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and Ari Douglas, I'm Otis McClay. Take it easy.